Hello guys, welcome to the latest edition of Sport and Life. I've got a distinguished guest who branches sport, obviously life. He's definitely very much alive, and he's a distinguished business person as well. Very busy person, I have to say, because not only is he the chairman of Gloucester Rugby, he's also the chairman of the Cheltenham Racecourse, which is, I guess, at the heart, both aspects of this part of the world. We're meeting in the Frog Mill pub in Andoversford, just outside Cheltenham. It's Martin St. Quinton. Martin, thank you. I do appreciate your time, because evidently you're a very busy man with those two jobs in particular and the rest of your interests.
Yeah, it's kind of you. I'm always happy to speak to you, but I am busy, but you can always, you know, there's always plenty of hours in the day to fit in important appointments.
Yeah, you're really good as well, because we did it on the phone. We tried to work out a time when our diaries would collide, and you sort of, at one point, I think we'd agree for Friday, and you realised you had to be going to Manchester for the opening game of the season for Gloucester Rugby against Sale. But is it juggling the two is good planning? Is that the key?
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's funny because, of course, June, July, August and sort of September normally are relatively quiet months. Both Cheltenham Racecourse and Gloucester Rugby have our winter sports. Mm. And so it does get a bit congested. The diary gets a bit congested like now. Gloucester had their first game of the season last Saturday. Cheltenham Race is the first meeting this coming Friday and Saturday. Gloucester play again this coming Saturday. So yeah, this time of year is a bit crazy, but it all works out.
How do you do it on Saturday then? You try to be at both, or is it a bit of both?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. When if Gloucester are at home, sometimes it's not too bad, because the first race at Cheltenham can be really quite early. And once the clocks go back, we have our first race at sometimes 12:30. So it's possible to be at Cheltenham, look after the trainers and the owners and make sure everybody's there and the guests, and introduce and welcome everybody and have lunch and watch the first three or four races and still get to Gloucester for a 3:00 kickoff. Mm. But the dream ticket for me is what's happening in November, where we've got Cheltenham races on the Friday afternoon and then Gloucester play Toulouse at 7:45 on Friday evening. So on that day I can be in two places.
I suppose you live more this side of Cheltenham, so actually it's quite logistically good for you to go from the racecourse to the rugby club.
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's funny because with the races, we've got no flexibility whatsoever with race times and days and schedules. It's all set in stone for years in advance. Whereas with the rugby, we do have a bit of flexibility. If we want to move a fixture from a Saturday afternoon to a Friday evening, we can do that, providing BT Sport aren't televising our particular game. So we have got a bit of flexibility.
That's the home team always has that.
The home team, yeah. The home team gets that flexibility. And some clubs play all their games on a Friday night, for example. Mm. Unless BT say, no, we don't want to film on Friday night, you have to play on Saturday or Sunday, in which case they have to move it. But
racing's more fixed because of the British Horse Racing Authority, is that...
Yeah, I mean, the race planning and the racing fixtures are set in stone, and the TV people have the times. You know, you could probably work out when the Cheltenham Festival is in 2023 if you wanted to really consult your diary and check that out.
Yeah. Probably are people doing that, to be fair, though, aren't they? Yeah, the way you've talked about how they come and camp for a week at a time in Cheltenham in March for the horse racing festival. How does it compare and contrast the roles? Obviously, I believe your title is chairman of both, but is it a different role in each in terms of your involvement in the sort of organisation?
Well, no, it's similar, really. I mean, at the end of the day, they're very compatible businesses. They're both in the entertainment industry. Mm. So, you know, they're both sport, obviously, and they're both about providing an excellent day out and value for money for fans, whether you're a rugby fan or a National Hunt Racing fan or just a sports fan or just a family who enjoys a day out. It's a similar type of business, but there are obviously, significant differences in between the two. But, I mean, broadly, they are complementary.
And with the Cheltenham Racecourse, is it dealing with trainers a lot and things like that? Is it, what's the day-to-day in terms of the significant partners?
Yeah, I mean, trainers are obviously a key are they a client or are they a part of the industry? I don't know how they describe themselves, but certainly trainers, owners are very important. We've got to look after them. Our sponsors, we've got to look after our sponsors. We have many thousands of annual members and we have to look after them. We have box holders who spend a lot of money on just to rent an annual box, and they are quite rightly pretty demanding because they pay good money and they want the very best food and the right wines and everything else. and the general public, again, who we have to make sure they come in, they have a very good day, they can get a drink at the right price, they can get to the loos, they can get their car parked and get home safely. So there's a wide cross-section of of people you've got to look after. There's the media, of course, who also
is it more of a diverse crowd in that way, the racing crowd, than perhaps the rugby crowd? Is it more consistent type of client in the rugby?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I mean, the rugby crowd tends to be more consistent insofar as the average gate at Kingsholm across the season is about 14,000 people, and those 14,000 are broadly the same 14,000 that come to every game. It does obviously changes, and over the course of the season there'll be, you know, a number of different people there. Whereas racing is much more diverse. So on some of the smaller meetings, it'll be predominantly Cotswold, Gloucestershire type folk who will come to those meetings. But of course, once you get to the festival in March, you've got 70,000 people there, and they come from all over the world.
Thousands from Ireland in particular.
Yeah, there's 20 or 30,000 from Ireland. There's people come from Australia. It can be a pilgrimage of a lifetime for some people. So very different crowd at the racing, particularly for the big fixtures.
And for you, your background in sport as well, I understand from reading Gloucestershire Live interview with you that you played rugby at school in Yorkshire. And what position did you play?
I played in the back row. I played number 8. I don't think we should spend too long talking about my rugby career. It wasn't a particularly...
But that must be where it germinated for you, is it?
I love the rugby. I played for school, and then I played at Durham University for 3 years and thoroughly enjoyed that. But I was an enthusiastic amateur, let's put it that way.
It's a tough position to play, though, isn't it? Number 8 and flanker is kind of action.
I think it was easier in those days, whereas nowadays it looks pretty brutal. I'm not sure I'd have fancied it anymore these days. There's some big lads out there.
Yeah, what have you made of that evolution of professional rugby? Because it happened when I was at school, actually. And I remember it was very much a different body type for each position, and it probably still is to a certain extent. But as you say, the professionalisation of rugby, the emphasis has quite often been on the physicality. It seems to be the biggest marked change in it since the dawning of the professional era in, what, 96?
Yeah, I think there is still very much physical body shapes for different positions. But what has happened, of course, is that in every single position is 20 or 30 kgs heavier than it was when in the amateur days. So you can tell looking at a player probably what position he's playing, but they're still all very big.
Yeah, they definitely are. They're massive, aren't they? Yeah. It's interesting that evolution of rugby, but your evolution from going to Durham University and then into business. And I've always wondered, part of the reason I started the podcast is what we get, the values we get from sport, how it informs other aspects of life. Did sporting background help you at all? I know that was a big part of the hope around sort of rugby and football in the 19th century was that it would make good young men. Did it help you in terms of your business career?
No, I'm not sure it did really. I think it's probably the other way around in some ways. I always loved sport, but I was only ever interested in sport as either a spectator going to watch rugby or going to watch horse racing or going to watch football. And I used to love playing the game, but only to a modest standard. I at least, you know, played all sports as best I could at school, but I never really... I don't think I took any of those sporting experiences particularly into business. I probably see it the other way around, really, whereby I had a business career and then tried to use anything I'd learnt in business, such as it was, to try and improve sporting brands.
Yeah, that's interesting. But I understand you've also helped sports people get into business. Have they been valuable assets in terms of things that they bring, I suppose, teamwork and leadership?
Yeah, that's important. I mean, there's a tremendous number of people in racing who once their careers are over, typically as jockeys or as occasionally you'll get stable lads or transport people who want to move and develop a career outside of racing in business. And certainly in rugby, a lot of the ex-players do look for a business career post their playing days, whether it's within rugby, in media or coaching or, you know, on the commercial side of the sport or out with rugby. But it's an area that I like very much, and I try very hard to help any current or recently ex-players to help with their career development. I think it's very important.
And do you find that they bring valuable attributes to business?
Yes, they do. I mean, typically these... You know, those people have been used to a disciplined environment. They're usually very easy to coach because they've been coached since they were 10 or 12 years old. They're usually very flexible. They've got a good work ethic. I'm very happy working with ex-sportsmen.
You always think that to make it to an elite level of sport, you have to be comfortable with sort of micro failures and development, don't you, to become polished, I suppose. And presumably that's part of being a business person, is that you have to deal with setbacks. It's part of the longer goal.
Yeah, if you give up at the first few failures in business, then you're not going to be in business very long. And same with sports people. You know, even the most decorated sportsmen today will all tell you about how they were dropped from the team when they were younger, or they were told they were never going to make it, or they were too big or too slow, or you know, they've all got their stories to tell, and those stories are true.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting that, isn't it? And a certain amount of persistence. It's just, I guess, channeling people into that next role and kind of guiding them through. And it's interesting they're receptive to coaching in that way. What's the difference when you've got a regular business, a non-sporting business, and then becoming, say, chairman of Gloucester Rugby? Because presumably your customers, your clientele are a little bit more emotionally involved than it would be a traditional sort of non-sport company.
Yeah, I mean, the basic principles are still the same. You've got to make sure that your revenues exceed your expenditure, otherwise you're going to go out of business really quickly. But the thing is with a rugby club or a racecourse is, particularly with a rugby club, is you've got every single decision you make is open to widespread scrutiny. So if you're running a small private business, you just recruit somebody, or you know, you might change a supplier, or you might export something, or you might open a branch overseas, and it's your decision, or it's your board's decision. Four or five people sit around a table, make that decision, and you get on with it. Whereas with rugby and to some extent racing, if you decide to make a change, then you've got, you know, probably, you know, there's 15 or 16,000 people coming to the next home game. We've all got a very strong opinion about that decision, plus another 100,000 sat at home.
I was thinking, if you sell a dishwasher to someone, they're not going to be bothered about who you're hiring to work in your head office, are they? It's a different thing, whereas sports people, most irrationally or emotionally involved, but it fuels the whole business. It gives me a job at Sky Sports. Mm. I mean, it's that emotional passion and commitment that keeps the whole professional sport afloat, I suppose.
Yeah, it's all about opinions, isn't it? And whatever you do, you're only going to please 2/3 of the people at any one time, but you've just got to make sure that it is 2/3 and not 1/3. Otherwise,
you do have financial regulations in rugby in general. Does that help in a sense? Because in football, we've seen Bury go to the wall, unfortunately, this year in very tragic circumstances, the football club. Because it is such a, in maybe difference with businesses, there's such competition to it. If you're going to ultimately get the succeed and the glory of winning a league or winning a competition, that perhaps companies, football clubs can overstretch. Is that safer environment, do you feel, rugby generally?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the great thing about rugby union in this country is the salary cap, which is basically the one measure that's in place to try and give everybody a reasonably even playing field. And I think that you'll see that, you see it every season, but you'll see it particularly this season, where all the clubs, because of the salary cap, and most of the clubs are paying up to that cap, are very evenly matched. And so, you know, you had the game last Friday night where Bristol, who 2 years ago were in the championship, there they are, you know, actually beating Bath very easily. You know, they scored seven tries to, you know, I think Bath scored once today or twice. You know, it was a few years ago, you know, Bristol versus Bath would have been a bit of a non-event. Bath would have won easily. Whereas now, you know, you saw London Irish, they won at Wasps at the weekend. And again, last season, London Irish were down in the championship. 2 years ago, Wasps were in the final of the Aviva Grand Final at Twickenham. And here we are, London Irish beating Wasps at Wasps. And so the league's very, very equal. And any team can beat any other team. And that's principally down to the salary cap, which makes it a fairly level playing field.
Yeah, do you sometimes wince when you hear the sort of percentages that football clubs pay of their turnover in salaries? Do you feel that's precarious?
Yeah, I think it's just wrong. I mean, I don't think it does anybody any favours earning those telephone numbers every week. I just don't think it's a healthy environment for the player or for his agent or for the fans or for the sport. So, you know, rugby's has got some well-paid players, but they're not paid an amount of money that's just changes their whole perception of life.
Yeah, particularly younger players, I think, which has been a concern in football, is in terms of achieving potentially. You mentioned the micro failures that perhaps when you give someone no need to earn money when they're at 17, 18, before they've actually reached senior level, that can be a demotivating effect and affect their ability to fully develop.
Yeah, I think it can. I think it can affect your whole attitude to life and your whole social responsibility. I think it's a problem. It doesn't affect rugby, and it doesn't affect racing, actually.
Yeah, it doesn't affect Cheltenham Town in this part of the world. Because it's an interesting cultural anomaly, isn't it? You're obviously living in this area. I know you get all over the country, including London, for business. But you've got your Cheltenham racecourse, and you've got Gloucester, and you've got the middle, poor old Cheltenham Town Football Club, who I know a lot of people from. But it's a strange part of the country, isn't it? That sort of anomaly to the rest of England. It's very much rugby country and racing country.
It is. Most of the country is football orientated. This part of the world isn't, and that suits me fine. I wish I like Cheltenham Town. I hope they do well, and I look out for their results. And occasionally go down to.
You're not a Leeds fan or a football fan, are you?
I was Hull City's my team.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I did serve on the board there for about 6 or 7 years in the 1980s, quite a long time ago, and I loved it.
Before the Premier League,
the Premier League. But when I moved down south, I couldn't. If you're a director of a football club, you've got to go to all the games, and it was impossible for me to go to any of the home games once I'd moved down south. So reluctantly, I had to resign. But it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed Hull City.
Yeah, that's interesting. What were the differences? Were there any differences in the ferocity of the fans compared to or Gloucester? Because they're a very particularly passionate rugby crowd at Gloucester, aren't they?
Yeah, football crowds and rugby crowds are different. The Gloucester fans are absolutely outstanding. I don't think there's a finer set of rugby fans anywhere. They are very, very passionate. They get very upset if we lose, and so do I. And they love the side to play an attractive brand of rugby and do well. They're very, very loyal. And they'll turn up in terrible weather and terrible conditions and support the team. They are really fantastic. And really, at the end of the day, the club is all about the fans. Football fans are different, but they're still loyal, and they want their team to win, but they're probably not as loyal. A couple of bad results in football, and they all want to sack the board and sack the manager.
Do you feel there's more patience for the manager, in particular the head coach of a rugby club?
Yeah, much more. I mean, I think that's well known. I mean, you know, it'd be very unusual for a rugby crowd to start chanting sack the coach and sack the board, and some of the chants you hear at football grounds aren't terribly enlightening. So certainly the rugby fans are they're demanding, and they want the team to do well, and they want the good players to stay with the club, and they want us to sign good players. But they've got more patience than the average soccer crowd, who, as you say, two or three bad results and they want to replace everybody.
But it's also, I think, it reflects as well the emotional impact of some of those games on the fans. It's interesting today because my brothers and I are all Manchester United fans through my dad, whose family hails from Salford in the northwest originally. But one of my brothers is younger. He's only 31, 32, actually. One's 27 as well. But they're lamenting the current state of play at Manchester United, because I don't think they actually remember pre-93 when they won the Premier League title. It's actually sort of causing them, my brother said he's reading something about the power of now and mental attitudes and not letting it external. He's a general practitioner, doctor, by the way. So it's like he's quite an educated guy, but he's reading this stuff about emotional kind of control, because he said the results have been affecting his mood. And he's got two little kids as well. It's quite funny, but you think that is a sort of thing. I watched the Sunderland Till I Die documentary, and you think people are saying, I'm not going to speak to my family all weekend now we've lost. And do you sometimes wonder about that sort of emotional impact on the fan? Sometimes it doesn't always seem healthy.
Yeah, I mean, the teams, it's a big thing. I mean, if Gloucester win on a Friday night or a Saturday, then you do have a great weekend. If they lose, I've got to be honest, I mean, I try and rise above it, but it just isn't a great weekend. So you try and dust yourself down and look forward to the following weekend.
Especially the away trips as well. I know you've got the great atmosphere at Kingsholm, but you went away to Sale in Manchester and got a 2-point win, which you said almost that must have been a jolt of enthusiasm when the final hooter went.
Yeah, well, especially when the final whistle went when the Sale guy hit the post with his final kick, which would have won the game for Sale, which would have been hard to take. The away trips are tough because, and it's very difficult to win on the road in rugby union. If you look at the stats, the home team seems to, I don't quite understand why, because the pitch is always the same size and the ball's the same. But
the psychology of...
Yeah, I think the home fans make a big difference, and they can influence the refs. And it's a big momentum game, rugby. So if you just get the crowd behind you and the ref gives you a few sort of borderline penalties, then all of a sudden home advantage seems to be enormous. So travelling to the away trips is pretty tough going sometimes if you've got beaten. It's a long old journey home, but you've got to take the rough with the smooth.
Yeah, you have. I think people love, they live for that hope, don't they, in the excitement afterwards. Yeah. How do you, when you're in the position of, I presume at a rugby club, you've got a coach who you're overseeing. How do you assess coaches' performances? Because people say it's results-driven, but presumably there has to be more nuance to that, and it's performance and signalling it, whether performances are improving or whatever. Because I think sometimes there can be, obviously you mentioned football, knee-jerk reactions to results when you look at it, and there's been a couple of bad results that have been, you know, someone's hit the post and someone else has deflected a shot in and the other team's won. But actually there have been signs that perhaps the team's playing better than the results suggest.
Yeah, I think, I mean, at the end of the day, the results are pretty well everything. You know, you'd be silly not to admit that, really. I mean, if the coaching's going well, you get a strong morale in the dressing room, the players are enjoying it, good players want to come and play for you because all of them they all talk to each other, these players, and the Gloucester players will say to other players at other clubs, "No, you, if you get the chance when your contract finishes, come and talk to us. It's a great club, we've got great training facilities, we've got great fans, King's Elm's a quality place, and the trainers are good." So it's all if it's working, you just know it's working. Equally, when it's not working, you know, one or two good players come in and say, "Look, I want to leave. I want to go and play for another club. I'm not enjoying it here. I don't like the training setup. I don't like the coach." And you soon realise that there's a problem with your coaching staff if, you know, the players kind of tell you, but you don't have player power where they're not going to turn up on a Saturday.
Body language.
Just kind of get the gist that the training regime, we've had that at Gloucester, you know, last couple of regimes didn't work well and it was fairly clear, so we had to change them.
Yeah.
And we're very lucky now, we've got an extremely talented head coach in Ian Ackerman and some very good coaches around him and a very strong director of rugby, David Humphrey. So, you know, we're very lucky, but if you coached us too well, then the next thing you know, the national unions are knocking on his door wanting him to go and coach South Africa or something. So,
yeah, well, they're doing quite a lot at the moment at the World Cup, but we'll see what happens against Wales. Have you watched the World Cup?
I watched it pretty well every game. Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Yeah, I've really enjoyed it.
Quite convenient in the sense in the morning you can get up and watch a game.
Yeah, the times are good. The sort of 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, yeah, it works very well. So more games this Saturday and Sunday, and then obviously, hopefully a big one a week on Saturday. So, yeah.
What's your pick then as an Englishman? Do you think they get past New Zealand?
I don't know. I assume New Zealand will start slight favourites, but I do think, I think both teams last weekend, New Zealand and England, both played some fantastic attacking rugby.
Yeah.
Both of their defences are very high standard. I think it'll be close. I think it'll be down to the odds. You know, we saw one game decided by a red card at the weekend. Hopefully this one won't be decided, but could easily be decided by a yellow. Just be the odd refereeing decision, the odd penalty one way and the other way. I think for the first time in a long time, England could beat the All Blacks. I don't think I've said that for a while. Mm. I wouldn't be surprised if England won at all, but equally, you know, could see the All Blacks winning as well. So
it's concerning if you're level with the All Blacks in the last sort of 20, 25 minutes, isn't it? I think they've got a record of pulling away from that point. I think you have to sort of put them in their place before that, potentially.
Yeah, and England, in all fairness, over the last 2-3 years, England haven't been great with 25 minutes to go, even when they've been leading. Mm. England have managed to squander some fairly big winning margins and either finish up with a draw against Scotland, famously at Twickenham last year, or just scrape home by a point or two. So I don't think any English fan will be able to relax until the final whistle's gone on Saturday, that's for sure.
That relationship in Wales as well, playing at the weekend, a relatively small population and a big love of rugby union, but the New Zealand cultural thing is phenomenal. I've never been to New Zealand, but I speak to people like Jimmy Gemmell at Sky, who's one of the rugby presenters and son of an All Black, and just that he says that it is the kin to football here. There's a rugby pitch on every corner, and the fact that, you know, a country that can dominate the world in a sport with such a relatively small population, it's quite incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, and Wales are also a good example of that, because they, you know, it's a religion in Wales as well. They haven't got a huge population, but they produce some absolutely outstanding rugby players and have done for generations. So yeah. Wales should be very, very proud of what they've achieved, you know, for a long, long time. But this is a real high moment for them. If they could,
they might think after scraping past France
good at the weekend, but if you sometimes you have a bad game in a tournament, and if you can scrape through the game where you play poorly, it can sometimes be a something that's not always terminal. So they could beat South Africa, and it could be the Northern Hemisphere final, which should be first time ever. So
yeah, you have to show a bit of courage, nerve. You have to show a bit of courage and nerve in business, which fascinates me as well. You said being comfortable with failure, but I believe you've bought and sold something like 70 companies. What do you look for in a company? Is it an idea or is it people? What's your assessment of what would work potentially?
It's probably those two things, but not in that order. I've always thought that people were more important than the product or the idea.
Mm.
So I've supported businesses which had fairly feeble product lines, to be honest, and not the greatest ideas, but they had very dedicated people who really wanted to do well, and they succeed. And I've equally bought businesses that had a sensational product or a great idea, but they were run by not the best people.
Difficult characters.
And they invariably fail. Yeah.
But that's an interesting thing, because you mentioned that with the rugby club, that issue of the players not being happy, not getting on with work. Is that something you look for? I guess it's emotional intelligence, how people work together. Is that integral to business?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't mean, just because a business has got poor management doesn't mean you wouldn't necessarily buy it. You know, it might be performing poorly and you might seize an opportunity to buy a business which is poorly run, but what you've got to do is be determined to change the management lock, stock, and barrel. So you wouldn't only ever buy businesses that are run fantastically well by a great management team, because they tend to be either not for sale or at a very high price.
Too expensive, yeah.
So sometimes you buy businesses that have got a weak management team, but as long as you know what you're doing and you're prepared to, you've got the right people to put in there, then they're perfectly good businesses to buy.
That's a parallel, is it? The importance of the culture, you think, for in a sports club and a business is just a sense of, I guess, emotional well-being of the staff, that everyone's pulling together and feels happy to be there.
Yeah, and Cheltenham Racecourse is a good example of that. You know, we've got a fantastic management team there that have been together for a long time. They love working together. They love National Hunt Racing. They're very proud of what they've achieved. Cheltenham really is the Olympics of National Hunt Racing. And we do have a very strong team there who know their job, get on with it, and they respect each other. And it's a good example of how the sum of the parts is greater than the individuals.
And racing's a fascinating sport as well, isn't it? Because people sometimes fail to consider it when they start to evaluate Britain's main sports. But then you look at it in the aggregate, we were talking about of gates throughout the year, the amount of events every year that on Sky Sports News, if I do an early shift, where we've got usually three or four race cards coming up that day, possibly more. You know, where do you think there's a huge, I guess, core of race lovers in this country, aren't there? It's a big, big community.
It is. It's got a very wide following. And, you know, we've got a responsibility to safeguard, you know, what's good about all the things that are good about horse racing.
Mm.
The flat and National Hunt are complementary but different challenges at each and different opportunities at each. I think it does have a very wide following. You know, nearly everybody has a bet on the Grand National and has a flutch on the Derby.
Is it more predictability in flat, though? Is the people who like a bit of jeopardy and uncertainty prefer the jumps, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit, particularly if the ground doesn't change dramatically. If you're racing on fairly consistent ground, then I think, you know, the favourites tend to oblige on the flat with regularity, much to the bookmakers' dismay, but the punters like that.
Yeah.
National Hunt Racing, by definition, is a little bit less predictable because you've got to jump around as well as...
You talk about bookmakers. I didn't realise how much market interest from punters there is in the ground, and you can bet on what the weather's going to be like. And so apparently around Cheltenham time, people are looking at it and saying, is it going to be, you know, soft or good to soft? And there's a lot of bets placed on
there
that.
There are. I think if you back good to soft at Cheltenham, you wouldn't go too far wrong. We've got an outstanding clerk of the course there, Simon Clace, who nearly always produces good to soft ground, no matter what the weather gods throw at him. But he and his team are very, very good people, and they nearly always get the ground to be good to soft. So if you were advising your listeners what to have a bet on the ground, then good to soft would be my tip.
Part of the magic of that week is I think David Craig from Sky Sports News always goes out onto the course with Simon to test it in the morning and does the course, and it's a lot of interest. But it's a magical week because it's around the time of Six Nations, isn't it, where we're coming out from winter to spring, and you get some freezing cold days, possibly a bit of snow, and then you get some of that spring sunshine as well. So there's a real, I guess, optimism in the air that week. It's a fun time.
Yeah, last year we were a bit unlucky. Two years ago, we had a very wet festival, and we thought that was going to be the wettest one in living memory. And then this year, 2019, it was even wetter.
Wow.
And extremely windy, if you probably remember. We were very close to having to abandon on the Wednesday due to winds over 45 miles an hour. And the insurance companies just won't insure the safety of the public once the winds get over that speed. So with all those temporary marquees and goodness knows what, we wouldn't have had any choice but to abandon. But fortunately, the winds weren't quite as strong as predicted, so we were able to race. But it's always a very testing time. The management team at Cheltenham are very nervous. First couple of weeks of March, they've worked all year for that, and it's it's difficult. Tempers are a little bit frayed, shall we say, leading up. We have to stay calm and try and get everybody focused, but it can be a time of a lot of tension.
Yeah, it can be tension a little bit. You're trying to, because of some reports come out sometimes of unruly behaviour, because people can sometimes imbibe quite a lot of alcohol that week, can't they? So it's I guess it's a case of everyone having fun, but just managing themselves a little bit.
Yeah, we've introduced various things, you know, limiting the amount of drinks you can order at one go at the bar. But typically, the behaviour has been extremely good at Cheltenham. I think some of the summer fixtures have had one or two issues where, you know, get a very hot day people start early in the day and by sort of early evening things can get a bit out of hand. But we've been fortunate at Cheltenham. We do have a lot of security, a lot of people on the ground to make sure there's nothing untoward. But we've got to keep an eye on that.
And you've done, just to sort of summarise the conversation, you've done really well in business. What prompts you to want to be involved, to devote your time and your energy to sport? Is it a feeling that it just contributes to the community?
Yeah, I mean, in a funny way, although I always loved business, but I never particularly loved the industries I was in. I was in office equipment and telecommunications, and there's quite hard businesses to love. I mean, I didn't dislike them, but nobody would believe if you said you were, you know, really found a telephone fascinating. But but I always found sport absolutely fascinating. So when I was able to, not retire, but when I was able to stop doing a full-time chief executive role about 10 years ago, I deliberately made the decision to get more involved in sport. So it was I love all sports, but racing and rugby happened to be my two premier passions. And so I was very fortunate living in this part of the world that I was able to get involved at Gloucester and then more recently be asked to chair Cheltenham Racecourse.
You can make a lot of people happy through it, can't you, as well, I think, which is compared to maybe, like say, selling office equipment, as much as people do particularly like a smartphone now, but I suppose office equipment like a photocopier, we kind of, some people appreciate it, but it's not spreading joy.
You can make people, you can also annoy people in sport, of course, if you make some poor decisions. There's plenty of people out there who are quick to quite rightly criticise if you get things wrong. So you've got to, you know, you've got to be very conscious of that you're making the right decisions and know your audience, because, you know, as I say, on a busy day, King's End will be 16,000 or 17,000 in the ground and another 100 or 200,000 people listening or watching or reading. And at Cheltenham, as I say, there's on Gold Cup Day, there's 70,000 people in the place and another numerous millions reading and watching and taking it all in. And so you've got a lot of responsibility to you know, make sure these sports are well run and providing good value and good entertainment.
Feels like the festival's growing as well, doesn't it? From, you've had the new stand a few years now, which is an impressive venue, and it seems to be that the interest every year, I don't know whether I'm more aware of it, but that other people are talking about it and from different walks of life I wouldn't associate normally with racing.
Yeah, Cheltenham's on a great trajectory. I mean, the crowds are going up despite this year, 2019, despite the terrible weather, really, we still had all-time record crowds, I think, on every single day. So obviously across the 4 days, it was absolutely an all-time record. And annual membership numbers, which we always think is a good barometer of the popularity, are again at an all-time high this year. I think we've actually stopped selling annual memberships because we don't feel as though we can accommodate any more. And all the boxes are sold at Cheltenham and at King's End, in all honesty. So, I think we're in a good place. We're comfortable. Sales for the festival are already, you know, ahead of where they should be in budget, and we're very happy.
Well, great stuff. Well, Martin, I know that you're a busy man. Any thoughts finally on the value of sport in life, what it gives us? Because I've got to my 30s and thinking, why am I still obsessed with this thing? I'm not a schoolboy anymore. Yeah. But did we get, I guess, watching mastery in flow, watching the examples from it, the value of practice, teamwork? I'm not sure. Is it just entertainment? What do you think?
Yeah, it's just so inspirational, isn't it, to see either an individual or a team just excelling at something, and I just love it. And see young people coming into the game, and you saw Bryony Frost at the festival last year achieving something that, you know, has not been achieved before, Grade 1 winner, female jockey riding. You know, I just, every day you can open the newspapers and see amazingly inspirational stories of you know, sportsmen and sportswomen who've just achieved unbelievable feats.
And finally, last one I should ask, because any tips for entrepreneurs or anyone starting a business? Is there anything, not take on too much debt? What's the best piece of advice?
Yeah, that's good advice. Yeah, don't take on too much debt, but money's cheap at the moment, so you can take on some debt, but don't take on too much. Now, hopefully it might have come across from one of your earlier questions. I would concentrate on the people aspect and make sure you surround yourself with good people and back good, honest, hard-working people.
It comes from experience, doesn't it, of known people and interacting, I suppose.
Yeah, I think it does. But at the end of the day, most of the successful businesses are run by people who do want to work hard, who are honest, who look after their customers, who look after their own staff. And those are the ones that usually come to the top of the pile.
Great stuff. Thank you, Martin. That's fantastic advice, guys. I hope you appreciate that. A little bit of sport, a little bit of life, and lots of business advice in there as well. Martin St. Quinton, chairman of Gloucester Rugby Club in the West Country in England, and also the Cheltenham Race Course there. Some fantastic insight. If you like the podcast, thank you for listening. Appreciate you rating it on iTunes. And please check us out on social media as well. Ed Draper 81 on Twitter is my main port of call. Thank you, guys.